And we are dedicating all of this to questions for our guest, Dr. Angela Rasmussen, our favorite virologist, who has helped us since the beginning of the pandemic navigate through all this complicated, changing information. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning, Ursula. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us. So our top story this morning is a real sad one. I'm sure you've heard by now that there's a Seattle woman who got the COVID vaccine. She wanted to volunteer at her daughter's school, and she ended up dying from a very rare blood clotting disorder. And her obituary says that 37-year-old Jessica Wilson was vehemently opposed to taking the vaccine, but she ended up getting J&J shot on August 26th, and she died less than 2 weeks later. And again, this is from this blood clotting disorder. What can you tell us? Why do people develop blood clots from a vaccine?
So we don't really completely understand this yet. We don't really understand what causes it with both the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that's available here, as well as the AstraZeneca vaccine that is available in Canada and the UK and elsewhere throughout Europe. But we do know that it is extremely rare. So I can tell you a little bit of a personal anecdote about this. I myself had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine on April 5th. I am under the age of 50, so I am in this prime risk group for developing this complication. But everything we know about it is that it is extremely rare. Now, that doesn't make it any less sad and tragic when it does happen, but there's only about 7 cases per million doses given to people who are under the age of 50. Now, while some might argue that any death is far too many, the death toll from getting COVID within that risk group is actually much, much higher than that. So while this is, again, tragic and terrible, and no question, this is a very serious adverse event, it also is something that's extremely rare. And I would encourage people, before getting really worried about their own risk, to really educate themselves on what the relative risks are. The risk of having this complication is extremely low. Your risk of having a more serious complication from getting COVID if you are in this age group, even if you are healthy and have no other pre-existing conditions, is much, much higher than that. For me, that was enough to sort of tip the risk-benefit analysis in favor of vaccination with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
One of the things that I hear from some of our more skeptical listeners or people who question whether the reporting is accurate on the adverse reactions or deaths, how do you answer that when people say, I don't believe that it's only been one because I heard, you know, this relative or this person who had a really bad reaction or in some case died? How accurate is the reporting system?
So this is something that I think people have a really hard time with, and also because it's kind of confusing if you don't really sort of know the inside baseball of it. And also anti-vaccine advocates have really exploited this lack of understanding about how the reporting system works. So in the U.S., there is a database called VAERS, or the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. It's managed by the CDC. And importantly, what people need to realize about this database is that it's entirely self-reported. These reports are not vetted for accuracy. And certainly some people will report side effects, you know, ranging from I had a headache to somebody I know died. But you never know how accurate those are. And importantly, those reports are just people who had recently been vaccinated. It doesn't mean that the vaccine actually caused the adverse event that's being reported. Now, the reason why these reporting systems are so important is that's actually how the CDC will investigate potential safety signals. And this is a great example of actually how that reporting system was helpful for this Johnson & Johnson vaccine side effect called TTS, which basically means that it causes blood clots in some rare cases. They identified that by digging through the data in the VAERS system. However, they did that by digging through cases where they could actually follow up and verify that this was, in fact, something that was linked to vaccination. And somebody just going to access the VAERS system isn't going to be able to do that follow-up investigation, which is absolutely crucial. So the reporting systems are absolutely necessary so that we do understand what the risks actually are. But looking at those reporting systems just in and of themselves is not a good way for somebody to try to understand what their risks actually would be from getting a vaccine. And it especially doesn't help you understand that relative to your risk of actually getting COVID-19.
Doctor, you did remind us all that you yourself received the Johnson & Johnson in April. And then since that time, there has been a pause on Johnson & Johnson. And of course, what we are talking about currently today about, unfortunately, us losing someone 37 years old to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Would you still recommend the Johnson & Johnson if they're a woman in this age range, in your particular age range, under 50?
Well, that really depends. I would not if that person was able to go get an mRNA vaccine for a couple of reasons. For one reason, and this actually has nothing to do with the side effect profile, but it does look like you may need to have at least one more shot to really develop long-term durable immune protection. And for that, one of the two dose regimens is going to be certainly better in that regard and more protective. Also, the mRNA vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, don't have that. They're not associated with that side effect. They're associated with a very, very low incidence of something called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which actually can occur with a lot of different vaccines. But again, it's very rare. And they are associated with a risk of myocarditis in young men. But for a woman who's around 37 or in her 30s or early 40s or late 20s, I would suggest going to get an mRNA vaccine. Now, that said, if they are in a place where they don't have access to the mRNA vaccines or it will be difficult for them to get a second shot, absolutely, then I would recommend the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And I personally would get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine again myself if that was my option.
Number two.
Okay, so speaking of COVID vaccine, we're going to talk about the safety of it, COVID vaccine safety and moms. Let's talk about the expecting mothers that are out there. When the vaccines, doctor, first came out, pregnant women weren't eligible as they were included in the original studies. Later, we were told that pregnant women could get safely vaccinated. Next, the vaccine was recommended, and last week, the CDC says it's urgent for pregnant women to get their shots. Why?
Yeah, this is a great question. So the reason why it wasn't recommended for pregnant women at first was because pregnant women were excluded from the clinical trial. That was one of the criteria, was that you couldn't be pregnant or planning to get pregnant. However, several people who were participating in the clinical trial did get pregnant during that trial because, you know, life happens, and there were no problems associated with those pregnancies. After the vaccines rolled out, again, life happens, so some pregnant people did get vaccinated. Some people did become pregnant after vaccination, and as time has gone on, the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices that makes vaccine recommendations, looked at the data, and they found that in vaccinated people, there was no higher incidence of stillbirth, no higher incidence of miscarriage, no higher incidence of problems with fertility compared to the unvaccinated population, which suggests that the vaccines really have no impact whatsoever on pregnancy or on the safety for your child after pregnancy. So the reason why now the recommendation has changed to say that pregnant people absolutely should get vaccinated is that pregnant people do, in a sense, have an immunosuppressed condition. In order to carry a pregnancy to term, you're essentially carrying another person within your body and sharing blood with that other person. And that means that, you know, the same problems that can happen when you have an organ transplant can occur. The reason that your body, when you are pregnant, doesn't reject the developing fetus is that your immune system is basically temporarily suppressed so that it won't recognize the fetus as a foreign object and try to get rid of it like it would a virus or another type of infection. So pregnant people are at a higher risk of developing complications with COVID because of that immunosuppression, because their immune system is not really at full force. So that's why it's especially important that pregnant people do get vaccinated so that they have that extra protection against SARS coronavirus 2, both for them and for their baby, because as Delta has surged in many communities, there have been situations in which pregnant people have had to have emergency C-sections when they're not very far along in their pregnancies, when they're just barely starting the third trimester. And that's obviously difficult for their babies. And it can be very difficult for them. And the reason that this is happening is because they are at risk of dying from COVID. So in order to save their child, they will have to do a very premature delivery in some cases. So that's why, to just be safe, that's why we recommend that pregnant people also get flu shots. You should be fully vaccinated so that you're as protected as possible, both for your own health and for your baby's health.
Dr. Rasmussen, I'm going to ask you a question directly from our text line. I'm going to ask it exactly how it is stated here. Please ask the doctor her opinion why the state is making state employees who've had COVID, which has the antibodies, which are more effective than the vaccine, are still being required to get the vaccine. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I get asked about this all the time. And what people really need to understand about this is that it's not that infection-acquired immunity doesn't exist. It certainly does. And the majority of people who've had COVID will have immune protection against reinfection for some period of time. The problem is that people have very, very different sort of magnitudes of the response after having COVID. So one person might have a response that's equivalent to being vaccinated. Another person might have a response that's, not so great. And we can't really tell who is who. And even if you get an antibody test, we haven't defined what are called immune correlates of protection yet. That means that we can say by looking at your antibodies, essentially, we know that you have a level of immunity that will be protective. And it's really important that we can feel confident that people do have the most protection possible, both for themselves as well as for their communities. And we know that people who have been infected before, if they are given even one shot of the vaccine, no matter where their antibodies were at after their initial infection, they go up to the same levels as somebody who's had two shots of the vaccine. So that's why everybody is being recommended to get the vaccine regardless of prior infection status. The only way that we can be certain that everybody is going to have the same protection that vaccination confers is by making sure that everybody's vaccinated. And there's another issue, too. It's just very difficult to track who's had COVID and who hasn't. Especially early on in the pandemic, it was very difficult to test people and confirm that they actually had COVID. So somebody might think that they had COVID, but they might not have. And if that's the case, then they might think that they're protected when they're not protected at all. So for that reason, the one thing we can track reliably, though, is vaccination status. So if somebody is vaccinated, and it certainly doesn't hurt somebody who's had COVID before to get vaccinated, that's how we can ensure that everybody is as protected as possible and protected at a level that we know is safe and is going to really make a difference in terms of your own risk of getting COVID and potentially transmitting it to others.
Ursula, let's get to number three.
Number three.
There are, I believe, three. There are three antiviral pills in development that are supposed to be able to treat COVID. How much faith should we put in those?
Well, I think that we need to understand that these are all potential additional tools in a larger toolbox. And while the news about molnupiravir, the new drug that is being shared by Merck, is fantastic news that they stopped the trial early, basically, because it was so effective, that drug should not be considered a substitute for vaccination. Now, we know that vaccines are not perfect, as we've discussed many times on your show. So there will always be some people getting COVID potentially if there's still COVID around. And it doesn't look like we're going to be getting rid of COVID anytime soon, because we'd need the entire world basically to get vaccinated. So everybody should still get vaccinated, but you can rest assured that if you are vaccinated and you happen to be one of the unfortunate people who get a breakthrough infection and you start to get really sick, this drug is available to treat you. And what's, I think, really important to understand about this drug is that you can take it as a pill rather than an IV infusion. So that means it's a lot cheaper than other drugs like monoclonal antibodies. And it's also something that you can take early on, which means it's going to have the most likelihood of working, because antivirals are more effective the earlier you give them. So I think that, you know, we should look at this as something great that is potentially going to change the treatment strategies for people who actually get COVID. But the best thing remains to not get COVID at all, and to get vaccinated and reduce your risk of getting infected in the first place.
Dr. Rasmussen, we appreciate your time. I always have about 20 other questions from listeners, so I'm just going to keep trying. You know what's great? I got to just say, this is from behind the scenes. I actually had Dr. Rasmussen, you answered a question from a listener after the show, and I really appreciate that you do that even on your off time when you're... I know you have so many people asking for your attention and wanting you to answer questions, and I appreciate that you make our show a priority. Thank you.
Well, of course, Ursula. And, you know, I've said this before, too. I think it's just really a privilege to be able to come on and talk to you, because so much of this is about giving people the opportunity to talk to somebody who they trust. And I know your listeners trust you a lot. I want to honor them and make myself available, and really, I don't care what your reasons are for not getting vaccinated. If you haven't gotten vaccinated, if you have questions, I'm here to address them non-judgmentally. To me, the most important thing is that we don't have any more unnecessary deaths from COVID-19, and that we end the pandemic as soon as possible. So anything I can do to help with that and to give people confidence and trust.
Thank you, good doctor. Really appreciate you. Coming up next.